morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, the weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to episode number 251, and I'm just really excited to have on this week's guest. I got a chance to see Coach Potter speak at my school a few weeks ago, and he's so much in demand that I asked him that day to come on. And what's it been? It's been well over a month since you've been at Fort Calhoun, Mark, and I'm finally able to narrow you down here for about an hour or so. So I'm excited for that. So Mark Potter, the former men's basketball coach at Neumann University out of Kansas, and Coach Potter's going to we're going to talk a lot about basketball, obviously, but also Coach Potter is going to talk about his journey, his story, some really, really powerful stuff. And I think some things that no matter who you are, whether you're a coach or a teacher or whatever your line may be, if you're a player that is listening to this, the importance of taking care of yourself. And Coach Potter is going to tell us all about that. And it's really become him and his wife's mission in their life. And I know I was deeply moved by Coach's story a few weeks ago. And I made a beeline to him after he got done talking to some kids to make sure that or to see if he'd be interested in coming on. So I'm really excited to have him on. So anyway, with all that being said, we want to thank our founding sponsor, COSAC Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha. Coaches, if you or any of your athletes are struggling with balanced neck or spinal issues, have them go see COSAC Chiropractic. Follow us on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you're listening on iTunes, Spotify, whatever it may be, download, rate, review, give us 5 stars, subscribe. It helps us move up in the rankings, so be sure to do that. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me a pen and a napkin at gmail.com. Coach Potter, how are you doing this fine early evening here in November?
Doing really well. You know, we have been on the road a lot, as you kind of, you know, talked about there in the introduction, and we have this week been home for the most part, so trying to catch up on everything, and just was curious as to how many schools I had been to in Nebraska already. And so I counted it up real quick. I thought you'd be interested to hear this, but we've been to 8 already.
Wow.
In Nebraska, and getting ready to speak to another, I believe it's 15 total next week. Don't quote me on that, but Drew Harris in Hastings has all set up and ready to rock and roll for next week to speak there. So we've been in Nebraska a lot, and you know, we're from Kansas, and Neumann University is actually in Wichita, Kansas, so that the people will know, you know, kind of where I coached for so long. But I was a high school coach for 11 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. And so I started out in Cheney, Kansas, which is where we actually live now. I was in Cheney for 5 years as the head coach, and then went from Cheney to Cape and Mount Sarma, which is in Wichita, and that's in the basically in the city league. So you're playing against all the other public schools there. But I was there for 5 years, and I went to Wichita South, which is also in the city league, and was there for 1 year prior to restarting in the basketball program at Neumann University.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're kind of like Led Zeppelin being out on tour. You just don't have the private jumbo jet to fly around in, Mark.
That's so true. You know, the no jets here, you know, although Neumann University is the Neumann University Jets, just so you'll know.
Yes, they are the Jets. That is very, very true. So, Mark, you know, you've a longtime basketball coach. Like you said, you started at the high school level, ended up at the collegiate level. Neumann is your alma mater, correct?
That is correct.
Yep, yes. Yep. And you know, it's always great to come back to your alma mater to coach and to do things like that. But you inherited a unique situation when you went back to your alma mater. The program had been dormant for over a decade, 11 years. So you were literally starting everything from scratch. And sometimes that happens at the high school level, right, where, you know, the district is building a new school. And so you got to go in and that's pretty common, especially if you're a larger community, like I live here in Omaha. But collegiately it's kind of unique. So, what do you recall from that? What were some of the challenges that you faced in restarting a program essentially didn't exist for over a decade?
There were a lot of challenges. Matter of fact, you know, had I known, you know, all of those challenges that we were going to be up against, I might not have taken that opportunity. That being said, I know that that's where I was supposed to be, and the opportunity came. And, you know, some of the challenges, I remember, you know, my wife always talks about this, you know, that I came home and I said, I'm thinking about restarting this program that, you know, at Newman, and you know, I said, we have no basketballs, we have no uniforms, we have no home court, we have nobody on the schedule yet. This is in March that I'm telling her this, and I'm still trying to finish up my season at Wichita South, and we're pretty good, so we're getting ready to go to the state tournament there, and trying to figure out whether I actually want to do this. And it, the challenge is, you know, like that first year, as soon as I took the job, you know, I would go from Wichita South. I had to finish up, you know, my teaching there. I would go from Wichita South to Newman and basically be there till midnight, literally daily, until we, you know, I had to have players to start the season in August, you know, yeah. So I didn't have very, very much time to recruit. And so therefore I had to spend all of my spare time, you know, on the phone and bringing recruits in and doing all the things you've got to do to restart a program. And then also, you know, get the schedule completed and all of our home games at, I think we played in 6 different high schools in the Wichita, Kansas area that first year, with the understanding, and I would not have taken the job had I not known we were going to build a new facility there on campus, so we would have that home facility our second year. So, but a lot of challenges, you know, it was hard, I'm not going to lie. And, you know, the pay was not the greatest either. You know, most people think you make a move from high school to college, and you're gonna get this huge raise, you know. Well, I was at Wichita South, and you know, I went from being the, you know, I would have been the head baseball coach there as well, but since I took the Newman job, you know, I had to resign from the head baseball, and I went from there, you know, full insurance, you know, like at that time, 1997. I think I was making 46 or 47 thousand, whatever, from all the coaching and all the interest.
Sure. Yep.
And I took the Newman job for less than 30 grand, believe that or not.
No, I believe it. I believe it. Yep.
Most people don't understand, especially at the small college level, you know, they just, they don't, you know, they don't pay that great, especially in a situation like Newman was in, where, you know, they had, you know, the program was dormant. And the reason it was dropped was because of financial reasons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a huge challenge just in terms of all of that. Now, you know, with all of that said, you know, it was a great blessing for me to be able to restart the program at my alma mater, and also a great blessing to be there to, you know, get a program that, you know, had been dormant for so long, and in the second year, literally win 20 games in a row and get that thing, you know, fired up at the NAI level, which is where we were when I restarted the program. And just a lot of blessings came along with that. And of course, you know, eventually I got paid a lot more, but took a lot of chances. I know that, but you know what, when there's a calling to do something and you feel that calling, you better go do it. Yeah. So that's what we did.
Yeah. I'm an NAIA graduate, coached at the NAIA level as a student assistant and in my young adulthood. So, it is not the NIL machine that is Kentucky men's basketball or UConn women's basketball. I know exactly those financial pains that you're talking about there, Coach. So
that's right.
So how long were you NAIA for? You reboot the program and then you and you start out at the NAIA level. How long were you NAIA?
I believe it was 7 years NAIA, and then we made the full transition to NCAA Division II. No, I think it was 8 years. And so maybe it was like 11 years that I was the B2 coach, and then 8 years that I was NAIA.
Did they just think you were too comfortable and you needed another challenge or what?
You know, that's a great question, because, you know, we weren't getting, you know, they didn't allow us to give full rides when we restarted the program. And so, you know, you had to piece all these scholarships together and all, you know, again, you know, the challenges of that. And so when I remember one of the board members came to me and said, hey, you know, we're thinking about going, you know, NCAA or Division II. And I literally told him, and, you know, I mean, most coaches want to make moves up the ladder, right?
Yep. But
you don't want to make moves up the ladder, you know, if you don't have the resources to do it. Mm-hmm. And one of the major issues, you know, our gym was nice, but it wasn't, Nebraska Kearney, for example, if, you know, some people out here will know they have a really nice facility.
Beautiful.
You know, the MIAA has so many really nice facilities. And when we first got into D2, we were in the Heartland Conference, which were probably, I don't know, 60% private institutions and 40% public. And so you had a mixture of things in the Heartland, a lot more travel. But, you know, the board member asked me that, and I said, don't do it unless you're going to, you know, give 10 full rides and, you know, make do it the right way, because otherwise we're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah.
So after we hired a man by the name of Vic Turley as the athletics director, we made the transition. And then I think it was the second year we were in Division II, and I think I was getting 7.2 scholarships. So what they were going to do was slowly get you to 10, right?
Okay.
And then we hired a man by the name of Vic Turley, who Vic Turley had been an assistant under Tom Pender at the University of Texas. He had been the head coach at North Texas. He had been there and done that. Okay. So he'd been at every level. And he came to Newman as his last stop as the athletic director. And he came to me and said, you know, why are we not giving 10 folds? It says right here, we're supposed to have it, you know, by this date. And I said, Coach, I don't know. I said, and he just made it happen. And so it was literally almost overnight when he got the job that we had, you know, we had 10 fulls. And, you know, what a blessing that is to be able to, you know, go from, you know, scratching and clawing for everything you have to be able, you know, fully funded, at least from a scholarship standpoint. And, mm-hmm. and so, you know, it was a lot of challenges, though. I mean, you know, the travel we had in the Heartland, you know, all the way down to Laredo, Texas, that's 13 hours. Played in San Antonio, that's 10 hours. The last handful of years, they allowed us to fly, obviously. But I remember the first year we went down there, we took a bus, and you talk about a nightmare. You play on a you leave on a Wednesday morning early. I mean, like at 6 a.m. Wednesday morning, get down there at like, you know, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And, you know, the next day you get your walk through and you shoot around and you play, and then you head back over to San Antonio and do a practice and then play again. And then you have that long drive back. So you're literally gone from Wednesday at 6 a.m. until Sunday morning at about 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. So it was, some of those trips were brutal. Not all of them were that bad, but, you know, you get used to some of that. But the Heartland Conference probably fit Newman better in terms of some of the private schools, but, mm-hmm. you know, geographically it didn't. So they made the full change from Heartland over to the MIAA.
Yep. You know, Coach, you've been out of the game, no pun intended, for a little while now. You know, what are the things that you miss about it?
You know how many times people ask me, you know, Coach, you know, do you miss the game? And I always tell them, I don't miss the stress that comes along with the game. What I miss is the everyday opportunity to motivate young men to be their best. Mm-hmm. And to, you know, I spent hours upon hours, way too many hours, but hours upon hours watching film, studying it, and making sure that we, you know, knew, you know, had every stone unturned in regards to our opponent and ourselves. And so I loved breaking down film, and I loved practices for the most part. And the biggest challenge as I got older was, you know, just the motivation part of it. You know, when you're, you know, 29 or 30, you can go in there and use every last bit of your energy for 2 hours, and you may be tired, but you don't really feel it. When you're 53 and you're trying to motivate young men to play at their highest level, it takes it out of you.
Yeah.
And so that was the biggest challenge, was just trying to get them to, you know, having the energy in order to make sure that our team was, you know, motivated the way they needed to be motivated. And, you know, so that part I don't miss, but I really do miss the relationships with the players and practices. And, you know, games were okay once they started, but I hated game day because of the stress that I always felt. So there you go.
Yeah. I will not, miss the games too terribly much. You have the rush of, you know, winning a big game, and that's awesome. I will miss going to practice. I will miss, I think the biggest thing that I will miss, Coach, is, practice starts on November 15th. This is my group. What can I do? And I'm talking high school. Obviously, your season is much longer at the collegiate level. So adjust the dates. But we start practice on November 15th. What can I do? What are all the things I can do to make this group as good as it can be by February 15th and tournament time? That I think, and the relationships that you build and all the machinations that go into building that team up and trying to get it to the best point it could possibly be at by the time the tournament rolls around, and just that Saban enjoying the process of getting better and watching that evolve. For me, I think that's going to be the biggest thing that's going to be one of the biggest things that I'm going to miss.
Yes, and I do understand exactly what you mean by that. It's when when you're a head coach. How many years were you a head coach?
I was a head coach for 18. I was in at 28 altogether.
28, so almost as long as I was. But I was a head coach for 30, and when you do that for your entire adult life, and then all of a sudden you're not doing it when November 15th hits. You feel lost. and so, you better have some other things that you're, ready to do outside of the game of basketball to, to make sure you don't go to a place where you don't want to go mentally. Because I just know, even though I know what we are doing as a calling, that first year was really difficult because it's just a part of you, November 15th, and in our case, it was much earlier, but that's when you start the season up, and all those things that you just talked about, has the adrenaline flow at a level that I don't think anything else gives you, Mm-hmm. So at least in my life. So, yep. Just getting a team ready for a season, well, one way or the other, is a difficult task, but the challenges of that and that process, that day in, day out process of trying to get them where you want them to go is a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Folks, if you are looking for a good book, guess what? I have got something for you. Kings of Their Court, 3 Teams, 1 City, and the Greatest Basketball Season in Nebraska High School History is available today on Amazon.com. It is the story of Tim Cannon at Millard North, Josh Ludke at Creighton Prep, and Doug Woodard at Bellevue West, and the 3 teams that they had during the 2021 season, the chaos that everybody was living through. The story literally picks up with the outbreak of COVID in March of 2020, and it carries through for the next 365 days. Everything that these players, these parents, these coaches that they went through from COVID quarantines to George Floyd to the politics of the time to just trying to get the season in a somewhat normal fashion with these 3 teams from this one city that were ranked in the top 25 in the country. Now, think about that. That would be hard to do in a New York and a Los Angeles. We had that here in Omaha, Nebraska. It is a terrific, terrific book. Of course, I'm a little biased because I'm the one that wrote it, but I think that if you're a basketball person or if you like a good sports story, a very amateurish version of Friday Night Lights for basketball, this is the type of story that you're really, really going to enjoy. So go to Amazon.com, go to books, type in Kings of Their Court, and it's going to take you right there to it. It's $19.99 for the paperback, $9.99 for the Kindle version. Folks, check it out. I think it's a really, really great story, and I don't think you're going to regret picking up a copy of Kings of Their Court. One of the big reasons, obviously, that you're on here this week is your journey, your story. And like I said, you came to my school a few weeks ago, and it obviously it resonated with me because I understood I had not walked every mile in your shoe, but there were at least a few steps in those shoes, and kind of your basketball journey and something that you're really, really obviously open and talking about, not only with adults, but your mission, you and your wife to talk about this to young kids and to talk to them about how it's okay to not be okay. And you had a real, tough time period in your life where you were, you really, really struggled with, depression and anxiety at a very high level. And I thought it's so appropriate to have a chance to have you on here before the season gets going, because, or, you know, some folks have already started, obviously, because it's, we're into November, but, you know, it's a long haul. It's emotionally draining. It's a tough go. Every season is a tough go. Even when you're good, sometimes the hardest seasons to coach are the seasons when you have big expectations and you're really good because people expect so much out of you. You know, and so it's not just teams that are struggling or coaches that are struggling with wins and losses. It can be anybody at any point at any time. You know, so coach, why don't you just go, I'm going to kind of turn the floor over to you here and just tell us, you know, kind of in a nutshell, in a few minutes, kind of some of the presentation that you brought to my school and your battles with these type of things. And let's start from there and let's see where it takes us.
Okay. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak on a little bit of, you know, the journey that, as I was going through severe depression, didn't seem like I would ever, you know, end up where I'm at today. But it was in 2005 and I was in my 18th year as a head coach. And so I was really at the height of my coaching career at Newman University at the time. You know, we had, you know, you were talking about the expectations of teams, and you know, the year before we had won 25 games. We had been ranked in the top 20 the entire season and gone to the national tournament. So, you know, and I'm at my alma mater. It's, you know, the program, things are going well. And yet to start, you know, as you started to speak on that, and you know, I might hesitate a couple times when I'm speaking on here too, because when you start speaking on the beginning of the basketball season and what we're getting ready to talk about, I had chills, because in 2005, my life changed, and it literally changed on day one of practice. It's kind of the first day that I remember having any signs or symptoms of, you know, severe depression. And you know, I just remember that day when I walked in, you know, walked onto the practice floor, that I had this void in my gut and something wasn't quite right. And as the days went by, my mentality just kept I just kept struggling with my overall confidence level. You know, the chemical imbalance is real. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, when I'm presenting, I always try to, you know, explain that a little bit better. But, you know, it's basically the serotonin level in our brain starts to drop. And there's, I can't imagine there's a coach in America, no matter what level you're coaching at, that you are at some point struggling with something, because there's so much stress involved in being a coach. And that's, you know, for whatever reason, after my in my 18th year of coaching, you know, severe depression, you know, with incredibly high anxiety attacked. I call it, you know, I describe it as it attacked me. And, you know, I started to get symptoms. And, you know, I think this is where I hope everybody hears if they're listening to your podcast, and that's this. You know, I grew up in small town Kansas, and where I grew up, no different than, you know, in the Omaha area, Nebraska, all the small communities we've been to speak to, you know, most people are taught, you know, suck it up, pull up your bootstraps and go forward. Mm-hmm. And it was no different for me. You know, I had never one time, and I was 41 years of age when I was going through it, not one time had anybody ever spoken to me about a mental health issue.
Yep.
And so the stigma is so real, you know, that stigma that says you can't tell anybody, you can't talk to people because you are the head coach or the assistant coach or the teacher or the administrator. You're supposed to be in charge, you know, and, you know, society tells us these things, yet, you know, if we don't respond to what's going on with us, then you can get to the point where I got, and that was literally within 4 weeks' time, I started having suicidal thoughts. And most people are shocked by that, but, you know, anybody that knew me are really shocked by that, because I look like a person that has it going on, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a head coach, I was a father, I was a husband. If you, you know, at least on paper, you know, it looked like, oh, Coach Potter's got, you know, look at, you know, he's got the program going over there at Newman and everything's going well. And I have a, you know, wonderful wife that's always supported, you know, what I do. And she's been in education all of her life as well. We have two wonderful children. And, you know, on paper, it looks incredible. Yet internally, I was suffering in silence at a level that I'd never suffered before.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that stigma kept saying, you know, should I tell my wife? And you know, I kept asking the question, I should say, should I tell my wife? And the stigma kept saying, no, don't tell your wife, because she might think you're weak. And that's just the stigma that's been told to us for really probably since the beginning of time. And especially in the athletic world, you know, us, you know, the coaches in this world, you know, there's a toughness that we have to, you know, make sure that we show our team and show other people. And you know, we're trying to get our players to be tough. How can we not be tough, right?
Yep.
And we're trying to make them mentally tough and physically tough. How can we not, you know, lead by example? And so I think all of those things come into play when, you know, as I was going through it and it started getting worse and I started getting a lot more symptoms, all of those things were going through my mind. And you know, I made the decision not to tell anybody. And that's the wrong decision. I hope anybody that hears my story will understand that if you start to struggle a little bit, you know, please don't wait until, you know, you have 10 symptoms. If you're struggling, just go to your doctor and tell your spouse and make sure that someone knows that they can, you know, kind of help you with those decisions that go along. You know, my wife finally, you know, there came a point where I couldn't fake my wife out anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started, you know, I'd been in my chair and I'd be having tears rolling down my face. And, you know, my wife started asking a lot of questions and I still didn't tell her for, you know, at least a couple more weeks, really what was going on. And quite frankly, I wasn't officially sure what was going on. You know, like I said, nobody had ever, you know, told me, talked to me about, you know, what depression looked like or felt like. And, you know, anxiety was at the highest level. And, you know, looking back on my coaching career, I had anxiety every year I ever coached.
Isn't that kind of a permanent state for most of us to a degree?
It is. And I think to a certain degree, you know, we look at different personalities and we see, you know, how coaches handle themselves on the sideline. And you're like, you know, that coach right there, like that coach has got it going on. Look at them, how calm they are under that circumstance. And yet we know that doesn't matter the personality, doesn't matter how well a coach can handle it on the sideline, all the adversity, all the things that go with that. We just know the stress level they go through day in and day out, whether they're, you know, high level division one coaches or all the way down to a middle school coach in, you know, in Nebraska. I mean, it's real. And in my case, you know, the serotonin level started to drop. I had a chemical imbalance in my brain. I started to show a lot of signs at home. I was doing everything in my power to fake my team out, which I did. I mean, I went 4 straight weeks of practice and nobody knew at the university that I was so far out of it. Like I would go to practice. And after practice was over, I would walk into my office, which was on the second floor there at Newman, and I would just close my door and just cry. And that's because the serotonin level had dropped so far. I felt hopeless and I felt helpless. And people always ask, well, why did you feel that way? And my answer is, you know, depression and anxiety and any other type of mental health issue does not discriminate. It does not care if you are a head coach.
Yep.
It does not care if you are a student athlete or just a regular student at the high school, middle school, or college level. It just doesn't discriminate. And so many times I think that we think, you know, what do I have to be sad about? You know, that all of these great, you know, blessings that I have been given, and yet I'm sad. Well, it's just, if we can view it a little more like a physical injury, not a little more, we need to view it the same.
Yep.
Because the, you know, if you're not the best version of you, and I hope every coach will hear this, if you're not the best version of you, then you're not going to be able to give, you know, your best version to your team, and your team is therefore not going to be as good as they need to be at the end of the day. And so, you know, you have to take care of yourself first. And, you know, there's no question that every coach is going to go through some incredible stress throughout the course of the season, win or lose. And I just want, you know, coaches and anybody else that might be listening to understand that it is okay not to be okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I'm really, really thankful that, you know, my wife finally forced me to go to the doctor. And, you know, when I went to the doctor, it was the day before the opening game of the season. And I was, like I said, in my 18th year of coaching. And I was so far gone. One thing I had not done, I had not told my wife that I had suicidal thoughts. And shortly after, we went to the doctor and they gave me medication, antidepressants to help that serotonin level go back up. We went to a counselor. Shortly after that, I told my wife, you know, the truth. And, you know, I think, you know, there's just so many people out there that struggle, that don't feel like they can tell anybody that, you know what, something's just not quite right. And why we as a society, and why we in the athletic world look down upon that. And I don't honestly think we look down on it. We just think we look down on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a weird statement, but we, you know, all of us go through something and we're all broken people at some point. And in my case, it just annihilated me. And so I remember when the doctor told me that I had to stay home and I couldn't coach my team until I got better. I remember the relief that I felt, and that right there, there's my dog popping there. but that right there tells you how sick I was, because it's the day before the opening game of the season. I mean, nobody wants to miss the opening game of the season.
Yep.
And, you know, to kind of put that in perspective, you know, I was a head coach in over 800 games. I was a three sport athlete in high school, and I played two sports in college for 4 years, never ever missed a game in any of those other than this particular season when Dr. said, coach, you're going to have to stay home for a while. Take your medication, go to a counselor. I'll let you know when you can go back and coach your team. And it was the very first time that somebody had actually given me permission to get better.
Uh-huh.
So I hope that anybody that might hear your podcast today, that if they hear nothing else, that if they're struggling at all, or with someone that they know are struggling, that they understand, listen, you have permission to go get help, and you have permission to get better. And the sooner that we figure that out as a society, and especially in the coaching world, but society in general, the much better off we're going to be. So
mm-hmm.
I'm blessed that, you know, my wife forced me to go, and, you know, I got better. I missed the first 8 games of that season. And when the doctor released me to go back, I'll just be brief with this part of the story. But I remember walking in, and the one thing that I told my wife when the doctor told me I couldn't coach my team was, don't tell anybody why I'm not coaching my team. And there you go with the stigma again, right?
Yep.
But the stigma was so loud and clear that I told my wife, don't you tell a soul. So the only people that actually knew why I wasn't coaching was my two assistant coaches, my athletic director, and my own personal family. My team didn't even know why I wasn't coaching them. And, you know, looking back on that, I regret that part of it, because they, you know, they had all kinds of different thoughts of what was going on with their coach, right? Like, and so I would have done it. I'd do it differently if it happened again. But I remember going back to practice that very first day, the doctor released me, and one of my players turned around and saw me walk in and just sprinted down to me. It was like, man, coach, it's great to see you back. And, you know, we just, you know, just had a little moment. Like, it was great to be back. Like, it was like, okay, maybe a little, you know, somewhat normal life is coming back again.
Yeah.
And because I had been struggling for so long. And so I decided really at that moment that I felt like I owed it to my team to tell them why I hadn't been with them. So I took them to the locker room and I told them everything. And before we walked out, the stigma took over again, right? So this is what I told them. I said, all right, we're not going to walk outside that locker room. I said, we're going to keep this in house. Don't go outside that locker room, talk to your mom and dad, your girlfriends, or especially don't talk to the media. And I said, all right, let's go practice. And, you know, so the stigma is, you know, is extremely strong. It's still strong at that point. And 2 days later, we get on the bands to go play at Washburn University. And, you know, I had a I had a policy that freshmen had to sit up front with the coach. And, you know, I always laugh when I say that because they hated that policy. But on this particular day, it was a young man, a young freshman from Phoenix, Arizona, literally jumped in the front seat. Like, he was happy to be there that day. And, you know, he said, "Man, coach, it's great to see you back. And you're driving the van up to the, it's awesome that you're back." And so we were just having a conversation. And about an hour up that road, up the interstate, my freshman interrupts me in the middle of a sentence, and I could tell he was trying to build up the courage to tell me something. Yeah. And he finally did. He spit it out. He kind of stuttered for a little bit, and he said, "Coach," he said, I think, you know, when you pulled us, let me go back a step on that. So when we were in the locker room, I told him all of those things about who not to talk to, right?
Yeah.
And so he brought that up immediately. So you remember when you came back and you told us not to talk to our parents or girlfriends, especially don't talk to the media? And I said, "Yeah, Dan, I remember that." He said, when we hesitated, he said, "Well, Coach, I think it'd be pretty cool if you did talk to the media." And I remember just being shocked by that statement.
Uh-huh.
And not even understanding, why he said it. I was so shocked I didn't even ask him why he said it. And of course, it really bothered me. I mean, him making that statement to me bothered me so much. When I got back, I talked to my wife about it. We prayed about it. And, the answer was that freshman was correct, that I needed to talk to the media. And that's what I did. Uh-huh. And I called him up and I told him everything. And our lives changed overnight. And that was back in December of 2005, and here we are 19 years later, and we've been trying to carry the torch, to let people know that it's okay not to be okay, that many people struggle,
mm-hmm.
that it's the stigma, all of those lies that we've been taught, we're just trying to attack all of those and let people know that sometimes it's just a chemical imbalance. Other times it could be a traumatic event in your life that you just need to address. Too many of us try to handle our problems on our own rather than reach out and, say, "Hey, can I get a little help here on this?" Because, it's just a struggle, especially, head coaches that feel like they're on an island a lot. And,
yep.
I'll just tell you, in the 19 years since that went public, I bet you I've had, I think it's six head Division I coaches that's contacted me, probably at least 10 Division I assistant coaches, but then I can't count the number of Division II because that was the level I coached.
Sure.
And then also NAI that contacted me, and then along with many, many high school coaches. And you would not believe, Marty, the stories that I was told,
yep.
about the struggles that coaches were going through.
Yep.
And so it's just real. And, I just hope that people, hear the part of the story that's the most important, and that is reach out. And I also challenge every audience that I speak to, that maybe it's not you, but maybe it's your brother or sister, maybe it's your cousin that you need to reach out to and say, I'm going to walk the walk with you, because they feel like they're alone in the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I always challenge every audience to contact someone that they think might potentially be struggling with something, and be ready to help them.
Yeah.
Don't just ask them, "Hey, how you doing?" "Well, okay," and then hang up the phone. Like literally say, "I heard this, this coach speak today about mental health. I want to talk to you about that." And so I hope that people will hear that part of the story and understand how important it is to not only help yourself, but also to reach out to others once you do help yourself if you are struggling, and it's okay, if you are. So that, by the way, that freshman, there's a reason that he told me that in the van that day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because he had gone through severe depression himself in senior year of high school. He attempted suicide twice. Little did I know prior to this, he had attempted suicide twice his senior year of high school. Yeah. So
wow.
He knew that if his coach would speak about this topic, maybe it could just potentially change how people would think about it, and it would be a lot easier to talk to somebody about it. So, wow, he's way more wise than I was,
Coach, let's real quick talk about the the organization that, that you and your wife, Nanette, have, D2 Up, dedicated to uncommon principles. Tell us a little bit about that and what you're trying to do on a daily basis with that.
So when we started the company, you know, after we made the decision to get out, I made the decision to get out of coaching. My wife had just retired from teaching. So we were 52 and 53, I think, with our age. And we knew what we were going to do. I mean, I got out of coaching to speak, and that's why, you know, my wife came up with the D2 Up, and she's the creative one of the family. I have little creativity with, you know, about me at all. I love the word uncommon because I always use the, you know, a paragraph that always talked about championships that, you know, talks about how uncommon people are very, very rare and, you know, just so true. You know, I mean, that's why we put the word uncommon in there. And, you know, we strive for that. I wish we could say we were uncommon every day, but, you know, we strive for that in our business. And the biggest reason we started the business was because of, you know, we really wanted to touch people through our mental health journey and through, you know, my journey with a mental health struggle. That being said, there, you know, we have three other topics that we speak on with mental toughness, and I'd have to look at the other two topics, but 95% of the people that contact us to speak want us to come and speak on mental health and, you know, what that journey looks like. Our presentation is about an hour, and, you know, we've been so blessed, you know, in these 8 years that we've been doing it, we've been in 30 different states speaking on the silent, we call it the silent epidemic. And it's just been, it doesn't matter where you go, whether you're on the East Coast or West Coast or where you're in the Midwest. I mean, people struggle and they struggle a lot. So we just really, really appreciate the opportunity. We take none of those opportunities for granted. I will tell you that. It's just a great blessing to be able to help other people hopefully get out of, you know, a situation where they may find themselves struggling as much as I was, or even if it's not as much, or if it, you know, it could be more, you know, it's my mind. We just want to help them understand it's okay to go get help. So
coaches are absolutely loving our taking over a new program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching. And during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Coach, let's transition here a little bit. Let's talk a little John Wooden. It's always good to talk a little John Wooden. Every week, Coach, we have a John Wood quote of the day, and we transition, or we have this kind of in the middle of the pod here. We get this from Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. I've just got a random quote here for you, and I'll read it, and I'll give you a couple seconds to chew on it, and let me know what you think of it. How's it sound, Mark?
Sounds great.
All right, here we go. The John Wooden quote of the day from page 83 of Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. John Wooden quote of the day is, "Here's what I found upon becoming well known. You're not anything different from what you were before, at least you shouldn't be. Fame is just something other people perceive of you to be. You're no different. You're still you. It's their illusion. I didn't want to become my illusion."
Well, that's you know, Don Wooden, just you know, all of those quotes that he has are just incredible. And you know, that one, you know, I can have my wife answer that one, you know, like probably better than I can, right?
Yep.
But, you know, when I come home, you know, I'm not Coach Potter. And of course, you know, D2 is not going to be, you know, some big time coach anyway. But,
sure.
But the bottom line is there are people that think you are, and you're in a position where people think that, you know, you got it going on, like I talked about earlier. And
you're something more than what you really are.
You're something more than you really are. And yep. You're just a human being trying to keep your head above water, just like that same person might be thinking you're more than what you really are. And you know, Coach Wooden's statement there, it hits home. And why it hits home so much for me is I always, always thought it was important to, you know, make sure that our players understood the importance of, you know, acting the way they were supposed to act on and off the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And representing themselves in a way that other people know that you respect them. Because no, you know, we're not owed anything. You know, this great game of basketball gave us an opportunity to do something that we love for, you know, a long time. And, you know, I say that so humbly that, you know, how blessed are we to even have that opportunity. So we are just who we are, and we're nothing more than that. And I think it's really important for other people to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, maybe that's the part of the equation that I wanted to talk about, is that, you know, you just want them to walk away from a conversation with you, at least I hope they do, and they say, you know, he's just a down-home guy.
Yeah,
you know, he's the down-home good old boy that loves the game of basketball and loves life and wants to help other people. And, you know, that's I hope that's what people think of me, you know, after we have a conversation. So there you go.
Well, yeah, I really think it's about the legacy that you leave, and you know, Coach, with everything that you're doing with mental health and all of those different things, of all the games that you won in your coaching career, you would give up all of those wins for all the people that you've been able to help. And that's the legacy, you know, that's the legacy that you're leaving. And if it doesn't do anybody any good, to win or to do all of those things, and not treat people the right way to make you think that you're something better than you are, you're not, you're truly not. Hey, if there's a competition, guess what? One person, one team is going to win, and one person, one team is going to lose. That's just the way it works. Unless it's college football from the 1970s or 80s, and there's a tie at the end of the game. You know,
yes.
You know. So, yeah, we want to win, but if you have to kind of sell your soul in order to win, if you forget who you are in order to win, then have you really won? I think you lose more in that regard. That's my opinion.
Well, your opinion is spot on, because if you do have to sell your soul to win, you know, basketball games or whatever sport it is you're coaching, then, you know, you said it. I think, you know, instead of winning, you actually lose. You know, what good would it do? And I think that's, you know, maybe not that I want to get into this conversation, but I guess that's the issue that I have with, you know, college, you know, sports nowadays, is that it's not played for the purity of what it should be because of all the money and all the things that are going on. And I'm not here to say that they shouldn't get paid. I'm just, you know, I can't remember what coach it was I heard. Oh, it's Tony Bennett when he retired. How about that, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
You know, yep. You know, you talk about class person, class act, high level program, and you know, he's leaving right before the season starts because he doesn't feel like he has the energy to continue to do what he's been doing so well for so long. And you know, it's just, that's the hard part about what we see today, is that I think in some cases, you know, one of my former players is an assistant coach at Texas Tech, and he said, No, I always talk about relationships. You got to build relationships, you know, not just when they get here, but if you want a great player, you got to build a relationship, recruit them the way you want to recruit them, built them there. And, you know, his comment to me was, he said, Coach, he said, unfortunately, you can build the greatest relationship ever. And he says, I still do that. I still work hard at that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but it comes down to how much can we give them?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just thought, how sad is that?
Yeah.
That, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to come down to the, you know, to the dollar sign, and it's not going to be about that relationship anymore. And, And that's you know, without speaking for Tony Bennett, I mean, I heard his postgame, I mean, his retirement speech, and you know, he talked a lot about some of those things. Anyway, I don't know how we got on that, but
it's okay.
It's just discouraging. It's discouraging because I do think that coaches, in some ways, I don't think any of them are going to try to, but in some ways, almost have to sell their soul in order to get what they're trying to get. You know, it's like, and I think a lot of them are dividing. Do I, you know, want to continue to do this, or can somebody get a hold of this thing and, you know, level it out to where everybody gets paid the same? You know, Tony Bennett mentioned that as well, but like, make it legit. Okay, let's pay him, but let's pay him some, a legitimate number that's not, you know, outrageous, that we can all deal with and live with, I guess, so we don't have to sell our soul. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
You know, no, coach, I literally had the same type of conversation with an assistant coach a few weeks ago at the outset assist. We were talking about recruiting and who you're looking at, and you know, and they were really excited to have a kid on campus, and felt really good about it. At their level, it was a big get just to have this type of player on campus. And you know, really? how you feeling about the recruitment? He's like, hey, you know, we want to build a great relationship with the staff. We want to make this a place that they fit stylistically. But and those used to be the two things that you would worry about.
That's right.
And the third thing, of course, would be academics and getting a degree, especially at like a Newman university.
Throw that one in there.
Yeah. That's right. I did forget about that. All my accolades as a intramural All-American at Briarcliff University didn't quite get me the endorsements I was looking for, but
you still got that degree, and that small college degree, it means just as much. So
yep.
You know, job well done.
Yep. But then he said, and it's going to come down to how much we can pay him. It's going to come down to money.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, that's the new thing. That's the third thing that we now have to worry about. It's not, you know, relationship with the staff and the coaching style. But now it's how much can we pay them? And, you know, it is just a different landscape. And
it is.
And, it's a fine line to walk, and I don't know, hopefully we get it figured out sooner rather than later. How about that?
I hope you are correct. It's, you know, you just hate seeing, you know, incredible coaches like Tony Bennett get out of the game because they don't feel like, you know, they have the energy in order to do all the things they're supposed to do. And, you know, you can read between the lines. I can't speak for him, but
yeah,
you can read between the lines and say, okay, he's getting out right before the season starts. And, you know, it's such a shame to see someone like him go. And it's because of, you know, what's going on in college athletics now. And so, yeah.
Yep.
Anyway, there you go. So, but John Wooden brought all that out of us.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And he's pretty good at that. So,
yes, he is.
Mark, you want to talk a little passing or a little rebounding? What do you want to talk?
You know, we can talk either or. You know, I'm going to tell you this on passing. Okay.
All right.
And I still do a little bit of small group basketball training, so I still keep my, you know, feed into a little bit, you know, when we're not on the road. But I have a saying, I don't know whether I got this somewhere or whether I made this saying up, but the saying is this: the greatest fakers are the greatest players, and the greatest players are the greatest fakers.
Okay.
So when you speak about passing, then, you know, you can have all kinds of, you know, passing. You know, back in the day, used to be, you know, chest pass, thumbs down, and, you know, all that stuff, right?
Yep.
And fundamentally sound, and you know, you still should be fundamentally sound, don't get me wrong. But I think what we've lost is the ability to understand how important it is to fake that defender out, whether it be with your eyes, whether it be with the pass fake, whether it be with your body. But, you know, you know, when you watch NFL games, and, you know, I know we're not talking about football, but quarterbacks are maybe the best at faking people out with their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I, you know, when I'm coaching and teaching those young people on passing, you know, I always talk about the importance of, You know, just, you know, if you know where your, you know, where the person is you're going to pass through, like if you think they're open, like if you can just get your eyes off them for a second, just for a split second, and make the defender move just a little bit with your eyes, then you've accomplished space for that person. Same thing goes with your shot fake yourself. Like if you can, you know, get a great shot fake and make them truly believe you're going to shoot the basketball and your eyes go to the rim on time, right? Like, you know, when you're teaching young ones, and I see this a lot when I also run a 3-on-3 league in Wichita on Sunday, late afternoon and evenings. Mm-hmm. Just got finished with it. We had 91 teams in it. And wow. Yeah, I mean, I started that after we got out of coaching, and 3-on-3 is the way to go. Like, it's how the, you know, you can't hide in 3-on-3, whether it's offense or defense. But, you know, the passing part of it, the shot fake part of it, you know, I see it every time I go to a different floor and watch a different game where, you know, I just want to stop them and say, you know, the greatest fakers are the greatest players, and the greatest yeah. players are the greatest fakers, because, you know, if you can't fake well, you can't create space. So if you don't jab well, if you don't use your body well, if you don't use the ball on time on that jab, if you don't use your eyes on time, like all of those little details matter in regards to how much space you can create. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, when people say, well, who's the greatest player? Well, you know, I don't know. You can argue all the time about, like, so, you know, Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Larry, you know, Magic Johnson was one of the greatest fakers of all time. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But so is Michael Jordan. Like, you watch this change of pace and how he uses his body and making him believe that, you know, he's going and he doesn't, and he, you know, changes the pace again. Like, he was so great at that. Larry Bird. I mean, I'm going down. It's old school people, but
sure.
There's some great ones now that do the same thing. But that's why they play at the highest level. And, you know, I just wish coaches would really emphasize that a lot more in regards to, you know, what they do in their passing drills, what they do in their shooting, you know, when they're working on shot fakes and actually, you know, making moves off of those shot fakes and stuff. So, I don't know, I got onto a little tangent there, but
no, that's okay. No.
But it is just something that I think is really important. One other thing that I see a lot of now as well, and I suppose it was there. I mean, I would see some when I was still coaching, but I just don't remember seeing it as much. Maybe it's because I'm looking for it more now, is, you know, a right-hander using, you know, catching the basketball and being on the right pivot foot. You know, uh-huh. It just shouldn't be. You know, you every coach could tell, okay, you know, we teach using the jump stop. That way you can use either pivot. What I'm talking about is in a regular circumstance where you catch the basketball and you're either getting ready to, you know, make a move, or, you know, you should be on your left pivot foot. You should be using your left pivot foot if you're a right-hander. And, I mean, you watch any NBA game, you watch any, you know, college women or men's game, or WNBA, and you're going to see them using the correct pivot foot. And I see young players, a lot of players at the high school level, too, that are using the wrong pivot foot. So the first thing I do when I have young kids that I'm teaching, and man, they don't always like it, but I make them jump stop and pivot off the correct foot, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the foot you're going to be using, you know. And I've seen a lot of great shooters that, you know, still use their right foot, pivot foot, and then put the left foot forward and can still shoot the ball. But I haven't seen very many of those. And then also when you're trying to put it on the deck and get by somebody, if you're using the wrong pivot foot, that makes it more difficult as well. So just another one of my little pet peeves of, you know, kind of what I've seen more of in the last 8 years since I've been out of basketball, you know, watching, you know, a lot more games, you know, from a different perspective, I guess, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
do you think, I had this, question, can you make a great passer, or is a great passer just born?
I think you can help a passer be a better passer, but I think great passers are definitely born, just like good rebounders are also born. You can make them a better rebounder. You can make them have the greatest effort. You can do all those things. But I just think you're either born to be a great passer or you're not. Now, the fundamental side of it is that's what we coaches love, right?
Yep.
So you don't have to be a great passer in order to, hey, we got a 2-on-1 and we're heading to the rim. And, you know, we're not 6'9 apiece. So we're either going to take it ourselves, depending on what the defender does, or in most cases, I always say most, not all, because you never say all. You're gonna give a bounce pass to a basket cutter. That's old school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I see so many, you know, you can help them understand the fundamentally sound things that they can do. And I love the coaches, you know, I walk into practice and they're working on all those, you know, basic fundamental things that really help their team to be better. And, you know, so you can do those kind of things. But instinctively, I think it's really, you know, I think great passers are born with, you know, with that ability.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a head coach for 30 years, like we said earlier, 11 at the high school level and 19 at the college level. Okay. I can tell you that I've had one rebounder in 30 years. That I thought when he came out of the womb, that dude knew where he was supposed to be 2 passes ahead.
Yeah. Yeah.
like literally understood positioning where he was supposed to be 2 passes ahead, already in position to, you know, get a body on somebody early enough so that you're not off balance and all the things you've got to do with that. And also understood when he wasn't supposed to go get a body on somebody. And that might make a few coaches nervous right there.
Yeah.
That I said that. But there's just times when I think his coaches work so hard at trying to get our guys to make contact with somebody that we overdo it. You know, it's that understanding of, well, okay, you know what? I'm going to step out of what, you know, Coach Seward, my college coach, and many, there's probably many people listening to your podcast that know who Jim Seward is.
Yep. Omaha.
He lives in Omaha.
Yep.
Lives in Omaha, and he was my college coach, and I, you know, I was his assistant for 2 years before I, you know, went out to be a head coach at the high school level, and you know, Coach Seward, you know that man is one of the brightest X and O and fundamentally sound men you've ever met, and you know, so he, you know, I got all of that, you know, that rebounding thing, you know, you always talked about TA, right? And so he had a phrase for everything that we did. And so, I picked up on that. And, you know, TA is the area. And I always tell the little kids it's Turkey Alley. Okay.
Okay.
I'm not gonna say the other one that we say in college. Okay. It's not really that bad, but
yep.
I'm just not gonna say it.
Remember what we said, Coach, PG-13.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
PG-13, exactly.
Yep.
And it, you know, so, but it's an area on the court, depending on how far the shot is being taken, where you have to be outside of, if you can, like the ultimate goal is to be outside of TA and already have position on the, you know, the defender or the offensive player that's trying to go get the rebound.
Uh-huh.
So it's always being ahead of the game. And I just thought that was just a genius technique that, you know, he taught us. You know, it's, you know, I remember we had a 3-player drill in, we would start with basically our heads under the net, which you're not supposed to be rebounding. But when he shot the ball, we would immediately get out. We would turn our head. We would look for the offensive rebounder, and we would get out of TA. So we had plenty of room to, you know, so that ball didn't bounce over our head. Mm-hmm. And then we would run a, you know, a full court, you know, 3-man, you know, Coach Seward was huge on, you know, the full court game. And we would get the ball up and down, and, you know, he was way ahead of his time back in 1983, 84, 84, 85 when I played for him, because we did not have the 3-point line, and his philosophy was still we were going to get 80 shots up every single game.
Uh-huh.
And if we didn't, then we were going to pay the price in practice for it. So, like, there's a way to think and a way to play, and this is the way we're going to do it, and, you know, and, you know, you make adjustments going forward, but man, Coach taught me so much about the game. It was, he was incredible. And he's still doing it. I mean, he's still teaching. I coach is, I don't know what his age is now, but he's still up there teaching. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, I know one of my former players, Corey Reedy, who lives in Omaha, he texted me the other day. And he, you know, his daughter's is going to see Coach Short is teaching his daughter. It was really cool. You know, it's
a full circle moment.
Full circle moment. Yeah. And, you know, you get a picture and, you know, it's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. So I don't know. I got off on a little tangent there. I didn't really give you drills, but I think drills are, I love drills. I have a lot of drills myself, but I just think the very basic fundamental things that, you know, we can teach in terms of when shot fake, pass fake, you know, jabs, all the fakes that we do are just way more important than people emphasize. And then I don't think I've finished the story on the one rebounder that I had in 30 years. Like that young man, he was not talented in any other area. He was a great, incredible athlete now.
Yeah.
An incredible athlete. But he was not talented. He could not a good shooter. He struggled a little bit defensively. You know, offensively, he just wasn't a great player because he wasn't a great, but I've never had a rebounder even remotely close to that guy. So, like, he had what I would call an NBA rebounding mentality that nobody can teach that. He was born with.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And so that being said, you can teach rebounders to be a lot better. You know, teach them where to go, how to go, when to go, you know, all the philosophies that, you know, you talk about with that. So
best rebounder I ever coached, and I coached girls for all but 1 year, girls or women. She was 5'8", but she just had a knack, and she was a great athlete, springy, you know, could really go get it. Mm-hmm. But boy, she just did a terrific job of reading the ball, coming off the rim, going to get it. Just unbelievable job. And it, you know, it had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with her instincts and her ability to make those plays. And we didn't have to work very much on rebounding drills those 3 or 4 years that she played for me. Yeah.
It's just a beautiful thing when you have someone that just gets it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, if you get somebody like that, you know, whether it's a, you know, a shooter that's just pure, or, you know, the same thing I think applies to shooting. You teach somebody to be a better shooter, but they're never probably going to be a pure shooter unless they're born that way, right?
Yep.
But if you get one of those people that's the rebounder we're talking about, or the shooter, or, you know, an incredible fake or whatever, it's just such a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I always said, you know, those players, they make you look like you can coach, even though you had nothing to do with what they're doing.
Make you look a heck of a lot smarter than you really are.
They sure do. Sure do. It's amazing how that works, isn't it?
Yep. Want to know more about a pen and a napkin and all the resources it offers? Go to apenandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. apenandanapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. A Pen and a Napkin University videos are just another way that A Pen and a Napkin can help you become a better coach. Our university video library is constantly expanding, with topics ranging from interviewing for a job to full court defense to 25 universal truths about coaching. Our university videos will help you round out your skill set as a coach and help you hone your craft. Videos are $10 a piece, with bundling options available. To order, you can DM me on Twitter, send me an email at apenandanapkin@gmail.com, or order from our website, apenandanapkin.com. Be sure to check out the A Pen and a Napkin video library.
Yeah.
Coach, let's you brought up Jim Seward, and I'm going to just be honest with you. We're going to go off track here a little bit in our last little segment, but you talked about Coach Seward. You talked about his philosophy, you know, 80 shots a game, and getting it up here. And again, we're taping this in early November, so a lot of high school coaches haven't started yet. But you know, colleges have obviously gotten going and everything. But you know, the importance of taking a look at your philosophy, and I think this is really part of the art of coaching, Mark. Here's what we want to do. Here's what we think we can do. How long How do we implement that philosophy mentally, physically? How long do we stick with it if we feel like it's not working? You know, how do you evaluate your team to figure out what's best for you? What was some of the processes that you went through with all of those type of things to try and figure out what is going to be best for Wichita South High School? What is going to be best for the Newman Jets? And then sometimes it's kind of a game of chicken of, well, it's not working out the way I wanted it to. How long do I stay with it? Do I stay with it? Is it just, we just need more reps at it? I mean, there's so many different things to consider, but you kind of, brought that up with when you were talking about Coach Seward. And so I wanted to kind of ask you about that and what your thoughts were on those type of things. When you talk about the overall, as you're going into the season,
you know, every coach, like you said, they're going to have their mindset, and you know, most of them have probably got, you know, quite a few things they're already going to do offensively speaking here anyway. And you know, I always remember, you know, when I stopped playing. So I was a two guard for Coach, and like I said, we did not have the 3-point line. And so I need to tell the story because there is a mentality behind a philosophy of really, really pushing the basketball. And I understand, you know, I talked to a superintendent in Nebraska earlier today, is every high school in Nebraska doing the shot clock?
Yes. Yep. Yep. This is the first year for everybody at all levels. Yep.
Everybody at all levels. So that changes a little bit of the game because, you know, before where maybe a philosophy was, we're going to go down and we're going to get 5 ball reversals until we get a good shot, you know, maybe 6 or 7. That can't and won't be the case now.
Yep.
So, you know, so that's obviously something to think about as well. But in terms of, you know, the story I want to tell, you know, when I went to play for Coach Seward, I'll never forget this. And this could really help any coach out there too, in my opinion. Because I use it every year that I ever coach in terms of allowing somebody to have confidence. And I was a good shooter. I mean, it wasn't like I wasn't a good shooter. I was, you know, I was there to shoot the basketball and, you know, hold my own on the defensive end, but I could really shoot. So, you know, he said to me in our very first practice, you know, when you're open, you're going to shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Okay, if I have to.
Yeah, I've never had a coach like tell it to me like that, right? They've never said it like that. And so I remember our very first scrimmage. You know, we ran the full court game, and I caught the pass at about the mid-court line from the point guard and passed it up the floor to me, right? Mm-hmm. And I caught it, and I dribbled it a couple times. There was nobody on me, but there were 2 guys in the paint, right? And on the weak side was our All-American by the name of Johnny Bailey, who actually played a little bit in the NBA. He played 10 years overseas. Like, he was a really good player, right? So I took a couple dribbles. I'm wide open, but our All-American's wide open too. Mm-hmm. So I throw the skip pass to him, and our All-American shoots it. And next dead ball, I came out of the game, and Coach Seward said, if you're not going to shoot it, you're going to sit. And That's a pretty big statement right there.
Yeah.
And I bet you there are going to be a few more coaches in Nebraska, and I'm hoping this happens in Kansas in the future. Now with the shot clock, that will be saying the same thing to some of their players that maybe they would have never said that before, you know, because it's like, hey, when we get the good shot, let's not turn it down because we only have 30 seconds here to get it done.
Yeah.
You know? But there's such a fine line, as all coaches know, with, you know, okay, but that person, you know, what kind of percentage are they going to shoot from that area of the floor if we're going to allow them to have as they like to shoot like that? So it's such a fine line with that. That being said, though, the confidence level Coach Seward gave me was, okay, you don't have to tell me again.
Yeah.
I just threw it to our All-American. That dude really played.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, if I'm not going to shoot when I'm open, I'm going to sit. So you didn't have to tell me again. You know, I got a lot of shots up, and I got a lot of long range shots up, you know, in the full court game, and it taught me a valuable lesson about how to teach confidence, how to put confidence into players.
Uh-huh.
And I just had never been told that before. And you know, when you shoot the basketball and you're not worried about missing, You're not worried about anything. You're just worried about executing like you always, you know, you just let it fly, right?
Yep.
Just let it fly, and the result will happen, you know, whatever the result is, you're not worried about.
Uh-huh.
Like you're going to find a player, and if a team is like that, you're going to find players and teams that are going to be really successful because they're just not worried about making mistakes from that standpoint. And I think that's a really valuable thing to talk about. But Coach Seward taught me so much about, you know, not just offensive, you know, philosophy, but also, you know, defensively and, you know, just the very minute details of the game. You know, I felt like when I played for him and I was under him for 2 years, and don't get me wrong, you're never ready when you're 23 to be a head coach, but
sure.
I was kind of thrown into it, and you think you are, but you're not.
Yeah.
And, you know, that being said, you know, I did have a really, really good, you know, base in which to start with because of who I played for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll always be thankful, you know, for that. So I would, you know, philosophy going in, if, you know, if you never run what we call the full court game, I mean, it's, you know, FCG on the practice plan,
mm-hmm.
you know, 7 minute drill, that three player drill I was talking about, rebounding.
Yep.
It turned into the full court game. So we get out of TA, we get a rebound, somebody gets to the outlet box, and the other one is getting inside vision by half court, and we're running the full court game, and we're passing the ball up the floor and scoring as quickly as possible. So there's just so many things you can do with that, and just that mentality, I think. So yeah. I don't know if I answered the whole question, Nick. Hopefully that helps.
No. It's good, and I think it's a great place to kind of take things home here. Coach, can't thank you enough for your time here. And you know, obviously you're so open and transparent about your coaching journey, and you know, if folks want to know more about you, want to know about what you and your wife do, any of those, if anybody just wants to talk some hoops with you, what are some ways that people can track you down here in this wide world?
Yeah, so you can go on our website, D2Up, which is our speaking website, and you can find our email on there, which is d2up.speak@gmail.com, and, you know, send us an email. My cell number, I have no issue giving out to anybody, 316-640-9059. If somebody wanted to call and talk a little bit of basketball or talk a little bit about mental health, whatever it may be, we just try to be as open as possible to help as many people as possible. So, I hope and pray that, you know, something we said on the podcast today really hits home with some of the people that are listening. And I want the basketball to hit home, but I really want the mental health stuff to hit home. So
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Mark, I'm so glad that we got a chance to do this. This was terrific. I hope you enjoyed your time on a pen and a napkin.
It was awesome. And by the way, the pen and a napkin thing, Coach Seward was the one that, like, he literally, that's what we did. Every restaurant we were in, it was literally a pen and a napkin. Hey, what do you think about this? I mean, here we go.
Yeah.
Like, we would eat and we would. So, anyway, I know I've said a lot about Coach, but that's the way it used to be, right? Old school.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah. And that was kind of the nostalgia I was looking for when I needed to come up with some sort of marketing thing to have here. So, that's where I started out way back, Mike Power. My first real major experience with a pen and a napkin, in a literal sense, was we were at the state tournament in Nebraska, and I was at Briarcliff as a student assistant, and we had qualified for the national tournament, and it was myself and Jamie Sale, who was Mike's assistant, and, you know, obviously he's had a heck of a run at Morningside there. And Mike Power was our head coach. And then we sat down with Gene Steinmeier from Doan and Dr. Ken Rodas from Hastings College. And believe me, I don't even know if I spoke for 3 hours while these guys were, especially when Rody and Stein got going. I'll never forget that night in Barry's, in downtown Lincoln, that we were just asking questions and Ken and Gene were doing this, and Ken and Gene were really, really close, and it was just awesome. It was that's one of those coaching memories that will always stay with me.
Yeah, and I just one thing to follow up with that. I bet you that I could walk into my garage right now, and in a box or two or three, I have some napkins with some of Coach Seward's and ours. Chicken scratch, X and O stuff that we did at a restaurant.
Yep.
That's what to be at right now.
Yep.
And by the way, they would probably still work. Whatever it was, they would probably still work.
If it's good enough, it's going to work. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah, you got it. But I so much appreciate you bringing me on, Marty, and just appreciate you, taking the time and the effort to do what you're doing to help, our fellow coaches out it's just a great thing and a beautiful thing. So appreciate you, Marty.
Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate it. If you could hold the line here, we're going to wrap everything up again. Mark Potter, from the former head men's basketball coach at Newman University in Wichita, Kansas. Just a terrific message and a necessary message. We do need to take care of ourselves. One of the things that Mark, talked about was if you're not taking care of yourself, how can you expect to take care of other people? And I think at times you just got to be selfish with yourself. And if you're not feeling right, you got to ask for help. You got to know what you need to do. So hopefully Coach Potter, and his wise words is going to help out. Even if it just helps out one coach out there, well worth it here. And just take care of yourself, coaches. We want to thank him for coming on here. We want to thank COSAC Chiropractic, again, our founding sponsor. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. Download, rate, review this. Give us 5 stars. Say good things about A Pen and a Napkin. That would be great. And any questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com. For Mark Potter, I'm Marty Plum. Hope you folks enjoyed this. I certainly did. This was a great conversation. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.